Acme Lithium, a company positioned near the epicenter of lithium production in the United States. Since 1966, Nevada's Clayton Valley has been the primary production source for lithium in all of North America. Acme Lithium holds two promising lithium projects in the Clayton Valley region. Acme Lithium, U.S. trading symbol ACLHF, and in Canada, ACME. Web address, acmelithium.com. That's acmelithium.com.
The proceeding may contain forward-looking statements which may not be realized.
This is CBS Eye on the World. Here's John Batchelor.
The New World Report with Professor Evan Ellis, Latin American Research Professor, U.S. Army War College, Strategic Studies Institute. Looking at the new world, particularly the troubled nations right now, challenges coming from the pandemic, observing the global story of inflation. And then there are the presidential contests, the two big ones in this calendar year, Colombia momentarily for the first round, and Brazil later in the year. However, there is also the matter of Venezuela and the rogue state under the dictatorship of Maduro, who is denounced as illegitimate. Yet, Venezuela is rich in resources, chiefly heavy oil. The refineries of the Gulf of America, I'm told, the U.S. refineries, were built for Venezuelan oil. There's a worldwide energy shortage. The Biden administration has been seeking to offset the decline of oil, expected or real, in Europe by finding new sources. One source would be the Gulf, so far not successful. Another source would be Venezuela. Venezuelan oil is perfect for U.S. refineries. At the same time, Venezuela is allied boldly, no secrets about it, with Iran, the Islamic Republic of Iran, that itself is anticipating needs for its oil when and if and how the sanctions are lifted. All of this is a circling around revelations that Iran and Venezuela are now in active conversation about barter, about trade, about how an Iranian regime under severe sanctions because of the suspect nuclear weapons program, and the Venezuelan regime under severe sanctions because of the abuse of the Venezuelan people and Maduro being illegitimate, are working together. To what end? I go to the professor. A very good day to you, Evan. This is an alliance of the Axis powers in some fashion, and yet these are oil producers. What is it they're discussing, and what does it mean for the region? Good day to you.
Good day to you, John. A pleasure to be on the program. This is essentially an alliance of convenience. Obviously, the religious-oriented activities of the Iranian regime and the socialist populist orientation of the Maduro regime are very different. But as you pointed out, both find themselves under sanctions, both find themselves with a common enemy, the United States and in the Western world. And so both looking to collaborate for their own benefit. Venezuela, although it's sitting on 300 billion barrels of recoverable oil, mostly very heavy oils, as you alluded to, has a number of different problems. Some came from the mismanagement of that oil under Hugo Chavez, continuing with Maduro, which led to the neglect and breakdown of some of its biggest refineries. Indeed, Venezuela's national oil company, PDVSA, used to be one of the most respected, if not the most respected, in Latin America. And the degree to which it's fallen is incredible. But amidst the problems with its refineries breaking down, there was even a huge explosion and fire at one of its biggest not too many years ago. Amidst the sanctions, which have really impaired oil production and impaired some of the oil sector companies like Halliburton and Schlumberger from actually wanting to do work, Venezuela's oil fell to a trickle. It was down as low as about 300,000 barrels a day, off from about 3.1 million barrels a day. So about a tenth of what it was even at the height of Hugo Chavez, back in the days when there was hopes of going to as many as 6 million barrels a day. But so in the middle of that crunch, which meant less oil export revenue, which meant even difficulty in getting refined gasoline, which has to do with everything that functions in the Venezuelan economy, there is a need to get the oil pumping again and being able to sell some of that. And so this is where the Iranians came in. So about 2 years ago, through a series of deals that involved Chinese parts, but also Iranian mechanics, initially it was trying to help repair some of the Venezuelan refineries. And then Iran began swapping some of the grades of oil that had to be used as basically dilutants in Venezuelan refineries. That started about September 2020 with a formal deal. And of course, after a meeting in Caracas by the Iran oil minister, Javad Awaji, with Tariq Al-Assami, who is essentially the point man for all things Middle Eastern, but also happens to be Venezuela's oil minister, they broadened that deal. And so Venezuela's biggest refinery has been worked by Iranian technicians, El Palito, and that's actually now restarting again. And so what you have is a net consequence is essentially thanks to the oil dilutants that are coming in from Iran, thanks to oil support, a lot of this is paid for by Venezuelan gold, much of which is illicit. About $500 million, it was estimated, was paid for one particular shipment. But the bottom line is that means that Venezuelan oil production is coming back up again. It's up to about 900,000 barrels a day. It's gone over a million at certain points. And ironically, now there's talk with the reapproachment by the Biden administration to Venezuela. A general license could be given to a firm, perhaps Chevron, to export even more oil, getting it up to 1.2 billion. So the irony is that, yes, Venezuela is sitting on a lot of oil, just at a time when we're fighting against authoritarianism in Russia and elsewhere in the world, we're essentially empowering the key door for Russian and Iranian influence in the hemisphere, Nicolas Maduro, by giving him more oil money for use for illicit purposes. And so full of ironies, but Venezuela absolutely is, John, full of oil. But probably very little of that oil will actually go to the benefit of the United States in addressing the oil problems here.
Is it significant that Iran is now dealing openly with Venezuela in a way that suggests that Iran has no fears whatsoever of sanctions or of being identified in the region as an interloper? Do the neighbors of Venezuela acknowledge that this is now a fact, that Iran has planted itself in the rich resources of South America? Is that okay with Colombia? Is that okay with Brazil?
Well, Iran has been doing oil deals openly with Venezuela for at least 2 years now. It was never entirely clandestine. Essentially, Iran under sanctions with the end of the JCPOA, as you alluded to, Venezuela clearly under sanctions. There is a sense that those two parties had very little to lose. Matter of fact, it's interesting that contrasts to the Chinese, who have been much more cautious in trying to respect U.S. oil sanctions, and the Russians, who were a mixed bag, who partially respected it but partially flouted it until we openly sanctioned Rosneft trade about 2 years ago. But yes, Iran has done these things openly, and that's an extension on some of the more worrisome clandestine things that they've done in the past, sending their religious special forces, the Quds forces, in through Conviasa flights into Venezuela. Of course, military support, including the Mujahir 6 drones, which previously and now again recently, they seem to have provided some rumors of providing, doing work with the Venezuelan national military industry, CAVIM, in possibly production of missiles, or at the very least on missile technology. So especially for neighbors like the Colombians, and especially with center-right governments, the Colombians look with a great deal of concern of everything that's happening in Venezuela with the Russians, with the Cubans, with the Iranians, because it's a populist state that has become threatening to their neighbor. I think Brazil, which of course is many times larger than Venezuela with the military many times greater, takes it a little bit more in stride. But for all of the neighbors, anything that contributes to Venezuelan resources and boldness is of concern. And certainly for neighboring Guyana, with Venezuela putting claims over the Essequibo region, about two-thirds of all of Guyana, especially with Guyana having a military that is nowhere near being able to resist the Venezuelans, it's of concern. So I'd certainly say that indirectly, all of these things that are contributing to the life of the Maduro regime and its military and other power do cause concern to its neighbors.
A note, Professor, within these last days on 60 Minutes, the former defense secretary, Mark Esper, who has a new book just published about his time at the DOD, notes that during the Trump administration, ideas were entertained that included, I'm reading from the quote from CBS, take military action against Venezuela, to strike Iran, and, quote, at one point somebody proposed we blockade Cuba. I don't want to go backwards. I want to go forwards. My reading of the region, since I've had your guidance on this for some years now, is that kinetic action is futile, that what we're looking at is the changing picture of Latin America, and that economics and self-interest is a driver for the region, also endorsing or dealing with the democracies as they bring forth left-of-center candidates. Do I say that correctly, Professor, that violence or intervention by the military will not lead to a happy conclusion?
You do, John. And I think certainly during the Trump administration, there was the famous phrase, all options are on the table. And certainly as people like Special Representative Elliot Abrams looked at options from the State Department side in terms of sanctions, in terms of, Treasury OFAC, and in terms of Department of Justice investigations, in terms of negotiations, there are a number of different ways that the military can be used. I mean, to provide reassurance to Colombia, whose border security is threatened. To provide humanitarian response, limited operations like special operations, a lot of things short of a, kind of formal, Gulf War style takedown operation. Having said that, though, I think what you do see is at the end of the day, part of the logic why that did not occur was an understanding of the fragility of the Venezuelan situation, however unjust it was, and especially being involved at the time in a very expensive war in Afghanistan and in Iraq and in other places, the sense that a U.S. intervention would essentially take Venezuela's very grave problems and you break it, you bought it. It would become essentially our problem with the blame shifted to the United States for whatever consequences. It would shift our neighbors' posture towards it and make it look like yet another, so to speak, U.S. intervention in the region. And frankly, with as much franchised criminal activities as we've talked about, the ELN, the mining arc, the FARC in places like Apure, different Zodi commanders, regional military commanders, with their own running their own criminal operations in the Venezuelan interior, the prospect of taking out the power in Caracas, there's a very real danger that in a way even worse than Iraq, that the whole thing would have just come unglued in a just mess of criminal violence. So I think there are a lot of reasons other than just the limitations of military force why that didn't happen. But certainly, Foreign Secretary Esper has his reflections on. What he was trying to do, and probably Mark Milley was trying to do, to counsel the president to good ideas and responsible action at the time.
Professor Evan Ellis, Latin American Research Professor, U.S. Army War College. This is the New World Report. We're headed to Central America, El Salvador. I'm John Batchelor.